Welcome in to the Towel Boys. He is Mike Romala from RunRev.com. I am Tyler Bischoff here at Mountain West Connection. I guess I'm back from like a sort of double vacation type thing. I worked the summer league for 10 straight days, so I took that week off, and then I went on an actual vacation for like 8 days to the beach. So,
were you comfortable being away that long? You know, we had a guest host in here while you were gone. Were you comfortable about your chair?
Was it better than me?
He had some insight. Justin Hawkins. He had some interesting things to say. I don't know, man.
I'm pretty comfortable. I don't think the Towel Boys could survive without me. But anyway, that's where I've been, making money, more money than usual. Like I worked the summer league for NBA TV. I don't know how in the world NBA TV makes money on the summer league, because they spend so much money, like, to come out here and to broadcast it and pay people, and it's incredible. Like, there's no way they make actual – there's no way they turn a profit on the summer league. It's just not possible.
But I assume most of their money comes from, like, the media rights and, like, broadcasting the games and like, –
Yeah, I'm sure it's – yeah, and I mean, they're, like, 50% owned by Turner, 50% owned by the NBA, so – you know, I assume both of those companies are making plenty of money to make up for the probable lost money at the NBA Summer League. But I don't know. It's just always amazing to me how much they pay people and then how much they spend while they're there as well for, you know, because they're, I think the NBA TV people as a whole are there like 13 days because they come in before it starts to set everything up.
Las Vegas is a first-rate city. You know, you don't come here to save money.
I guess that's true. Maybe the NBA TV executives are taking the company bank account and going to the roulette table to see if they can win some of it back. But anyway, we're going to start with Chris Obekpa, the newest Rebel, although you won't see him this year. A transfer, big guy, one of the best shot blockers in the country the last 3 years. Coming to UNLV from St. John's, does have to sit out this upcoming season, but he will have 1 year of eligibility for the 2016 and 2017 season. Mike, I've come to the conclusion that if you were given half a point for every block shot, UNLV would have been to like three straight Final Fours.
That it's only going to get Okonobo and him playing at the same time like that.
That's too many. Like they're going to block too many shots.
So, I mean,
it's kind of like this last year, they went for all the block shots and it led to a ton of offensive rebounds. It's somehow going to be worse than that.
I don't know. I figure you give Okonobo two more years to develop. Like by that time, he'll be a junior. Obekpa will be a fifth year senior. Like that's, you don't just have, you know, good shot blockers. You have like good experienced defenders at that point as well. So I feel like that's going to be a pretty potent combination once they get there.
Obekpa last year was fifth in the country in blocks per game. His block percentage, which is just what percentage of opponent shots do you block while you're on the floor? He was 17th in the country last year, but his freshman and sophomore year, he was second in the country both years in block percentage. So he actually had a down year last year blocking shots, even though he finished fifth in the country, comparatively to his first 2 years. So, I mean, he's an excellent, excellent shot. I mean, he might very well be the best one on UNLV's roster this upcoming year. And UNLV was just one of the top five shot-blocking teams in the country. So that's where it comes. I know last year St. John's, they played four-guard offenses with Chris Obekpa in there, and it was basically like, you defend the paint. If our guards get beat off the dribble, you come over and block the shot. So he actually probably would have been pretty comfortable playing in UNLV's system last year where they got beat off the dribble all the time. So he's certainly capable of doing what you saw Good Luck Okonobo do on the defensive end, and he's done it at a higher level at St. John's. The other part is that he'll help the rebounding. He's not a great rebounder by any means. I don't think he's ever averaged more than seven a game. But his rebounding percentage is pretty good. And honestly, I think it would have been second on the team last year behind Chris Wood for UNLV. So his rebounding will help, but it's not something that you say, oh, we're glad we have him as a rebounder. It's more he's just a big guy and is going to get a good amount of rebounds. So on the court-wise, because we'll get to some of his issues or whatever in a second, but on the court-wise, rate this on like a scale of 1 to 10 for UNLV grabbing this guy for sit out a year and have 1 year left?
Strictly on the court stuff. Grabbing him when they did, you know, at this point in the offseason, finding this guy on the transfer wire, that's probably in the upper range. It's like a 7 or higher. And I think that's a pretty good get for this time of year.
Oh, yeah. And, I mean, he was pretty much a full-time starter last year. His freshman and sophomore year, he started about half their games. So, you know, he's not really a three-year starter, but a guy that's been getting big minutes for 3 years in college basketball, and you land him in August. So to me, it's tremendous. If you look at on the court, he certainly does some things that guys Dave Rice has and have done very well. So I think he'll be just fine defensively, and he'll help this team defensively.
How's he going to be offensively?
God, I don't think he's going to be very good. Like,
his numbers, I'm looking at the numbers right now. There.
It's not very pretty. He's like a 45% free throw shooter. He shot like 46% from the floor.
He's a 6'10" guy with, you know, the athleticism and everything. True shooting percentage for his career, 484. This is a guy who, I mean, if he's not dunking it, he's not putting it in, basically, is what you're saying right there.
So last year, his most typical offensive shooting was off of offensive rebounds, and his points per possession was 0.84, which is in the lowest 18th percentile in the country.
And if offensive putbacks are, that's the most efficient points per per possession play that you can have. Like, that's always like way, it's always over point. It's like way, it's always way up there. So if like, all his shots are coming off of offensive putbacks and he's still finishing, you know, under 50% from the floor, that tells you that he is like the ball. You do not want the ball in his hands pretty much under any circumstances.
Yeah. And as far as just looking at some synergy stuff, he's not really a pick and roll type player. I haven't really watched to see, but didn't do it very much. I just assume he's not. He only had 26 post up opportunities last year. It's a really small sample size, but he only scored 0.38 points per possession per post up last year. There's not a lot of good in his offensive side of the court, but if you kind of project the roster out, it's kind of hard to do with who's going to leave, and they've got like 37 guys that have a year left or 2 years left or have to sit out or whatever. But if UNLV is asking Chris Obekpa to score like anything more than the fifth offensive option, they're going to be in trouble. And I think Dave Rice knows that. Everybody will know that. And I don't think he'll be anything more than the fifth offensive option at any point
old season. I think you'll go, when he's eligible 2 years from now, I think you'll go games at a time without seeing him get a post touch, like without him getting the ball thrown down to him in back to the basket situations like that.
Oh, yeah.
It's you're not going to be asking him to make points for you. That's not going to happen.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing will be his defensive impact. And then on top of that, can he find a way to fit in UNLV's offense, whatever it looks like, and whoever the main scorers?
I mean, that's not to say that he can't contribute. Like, one of the big problems I think we both thought last year with their offense was the big men did not screen very well. Like, Okonobo and Wood were not very good screen setters. Like, I don't know enough about Obekpa to comment on him there, but if he can come in and be the type of guy that, you know, at least sets good screens, stays out of the way, grabs a couple offensive rebounds, like, you can – he can basically stay out of your own way. Don't hurt the team, but, you know, contribute where you can. You can still kind of be playable on offense.
Oh yeah, and if he can position himself properly to when Pat McCall gets in the lane, that Pat McCall can throw him an alley oop, even though he's got really bad shooting percentages, I have confidence he can catch and dunk an alley oop, and Pat McCall loves to do that. So there's certainly areas where he works, but, you know, you're saying if he can stay out of the way on offense, it'll be okay. That's not exactly the best thing.
Well, if you're shooting less than 50% from the free throw line, I really don't want you handling the ball all that much. I don't want the ball in your hands because it seems like bad things are going to happen more often than not. I'm looking at turnover percentage for his career, 20.3. So, you know, he's just...
That's high for a big
guy. Yeah, it's extremely high for anyone. He just turns the ball over a lot. He can't shoot free throws. He has trouble finishing around the rim. So it's like, putting points on the board is not what he's going to do. He's going to have to contribute in other ways offensively. And then there's like 90% of his value is going to come on the defensive end, just like blocking shots and sort of holding down the paint. And if you're okay with that for, I think I'm okay with that for a guy who is, they found on the transfer wire, you know, at the end of the offseason.
Yeah, and especially if you assume Pat McCaw and Jordan Cornish are going to be two good scoring players, you know, and you assume you can kind of fill out around those two potentially top scorers in 2 years, certainly you won't need him to score necessarily. So the off the court issues, was it John Rothstein that called him troubled?
Mm-hmm. I don't know if he said it in the story. I know that the headline. The CBS Sports headline said troubled St. John's transfer Obekpa.
And writers don't always write their own headlines.
Most of the time they don't. It's usually whoever's editing the story will put a headline on it, send it out. But that I don't have a problem with. I think that's kind of the perception about him. Like if you read the local papers, like the local New York papers, they all sort of label him the same way. So that seems to be the perception about him.
So he had a marijuana. He got suspended reportedly for marijuana.
Tested positive reportedly on selection Sunday last year.
I mean, which is usually they got a 9 seed.
I think I want my guys to be more focused on other things at that point.
No, because now you don't need to because you don't know who you're preparing for before they actually announce it. So there's nothing to focus on. It's okay.
I don't know.
It's okay.
I don't know.
That is still reportedly, but the New York Post had a story, and they cited a source saying that Chris Obekpa was transferring mainly due to Chris Mullen, who is the new head coach at St. John's, being too strict, and that this was in either June or July. I think it was in June. The summer workout regimen was too strict, and the New York Post used the words too disciplined.
I think I would take that with a grain of salt. That sounds like not for me to criticize another person or another person's sources, but that sounds like something that comes from the coaching staff. Like, you know, I don't think Obekpa or his people are going to be saying like, oh, I left because it was too disciplined or I left because, you know, it was too structured. That sounds like the coaching staff trying to get their message out there.
So the idea, it was Steve Lavin last year. Now it's Chris Mullen, and so Chris Mullen takes over. Obekpa's got 1 year of eligibility left. College sports is weird in that coaches can do whatever they want, but players have to sit out a year, and you've only got 4 years of eligibility, and you can lose one of those kind of easily at times if you transfer and stuff like that. So to me, I don't care if he thought Chris Mullen was too strict. I don't care if he thought it was too disciplined, whatever. To me, I am perfectly fine with a player who's had the same coach for his first 3 years at a school deciding to transfer when a new head coach comes in and deciding to transfer, you know, after practicing with that new head coach. Like, to me, and he's, you know, obviously he's got other issues or stuff in his past that people judge him on, but to me, I've got no problem if he was like, okay, I'll see what Chris Mullen's like, and after a week of practice, or however, I don't know how long it was, but after a week of practice, he was like, no, I don't really like this. I'm going to go somewhere else. I've got no problem with that sort of general idea or principle.
That's a little too level-headed for me.
Is it?
It's got to be something else there. It's got to be the discipline, or that he doesn't like discipline and he doesn't like structure. No, I mean, it seems to be the most obvious answer, is that, like, you know, he's been there for a while. He committed to a different coach. New coach came in. He hung out for a little while. He wasn't working for whatever reason. And also, I haven't talked to Chris Obekpa. I haven't seen any other interviews with him since he committed to UNLV. So I don't know what his thought process is, but maybe the whole fresh start thing played into it as well. You know, he'd had some issues besides the suspension at the end of last year. He had some other issues. So maybe all that played into it as well. And it's, at some point you just want to, you know, get away and enjoy your final season or your final two seasons.
So Dave Rice you can say he's gambling on a kid that obviously people think lowly of. What do you make of taking a chance on a guy that, it could blow up in your face, or there's a higher chance that it blows up in your face than, you know, player B?
Well, when I wrote about his commitment, I said it was a gamble because I think it is. I think that it fits into the overall philosophy, his recruiting philosophy, which we've seen is that he'll take talented guys if he thinks that he can manage them and get them to produce. He's done it with, you know, Bryce DeJean Jones, did it with Jalon Kendrick, he did it with Ken Burch. He's not afraid to take guys who have baggage if he thinks that they can play. So he's doing it again here. Considering the roster makeup, I think it makes sense. Like there's enough value there for this gamble to be worth it. Like even if the worst case scenario is that he gets in trouble, you know, during his redshirt year and he never sees the court for UNLV and he's dismissed from the program or something like that. That would be the worst case scenario. And I still think that it would probably be worth the gamble for your 13th man. Like that's your 13th scholarship spot. Why not use it on a big man who's talented, who has, you know, certifiable skills. Like, you know, he can be a good defender. It's like, there's no guesswork there. Like, you know, he can be an effective defender if you can keep him on the court. So it's like, I feel like that's worth the gamble for your 13th roster spot.
I've got absolutely no problem with gambling on a kid. And I don't know, I guess I'm hesitant to use the word gamble because it's like, he failed a marijuana drug test. You know, you're supposed to be smarter than that, but marijuana's legal in states, so it's not the worst thing in the world. St. John's fans question his commitment to the program, whatever, and then apparently the New York Post says he's not disciplined or he can't handle discipline or strictness. None of that is a huge red flag. I mean, all of them added together is kind of like, okay, I'm a little worried, but none of that is like, you know, he didn't commit some sort of felony or anything.
If you want a good comparison, like the best case scenario would be Ken Burch, who was a big man who went to Pitt. And as soon as he got there, you saw stories from sort like, hey, he clashes with the coaching staff. He's chafing because they want him to play center and this and that. And he's not fitting in. And then he transferred after, you know, like 9 games. And then it was, oh, he's a quitter. He couldn't deal with it. He's just not tough enough. And so Dave Rice took a chance on him, and he turned out to be, you know, one of the best defensive players in the history of the program at UNLV. So like, that's the best case scenario. So it's obviously going to vary from case to case. And you just have to judge each individual player and whether or not you think it's worth it to bring someone like that into the program. Birch was different because, you know, you were getting 3 years, 3.5 years of eligibility, potentially. Obekpe, you're only getting 1 year of eligibility, but I think that they still think that it was worth it. Obviously they did because they took him on.
I will probably always be in favor of taking a chance on a kid. And part of it comes from I covered Marshall Henderson's 2 years at Ole Miss, and you know he gets arrested for trying to buy drugs with counterfeit money and gets in a fight at Utah, and he was at 3 schools before he actually landed at Ole Miss. But he went to Ole Miss, and basically because of him, they went to the NCAA tournament for the first time in like 11 years, I think it was. So I will, and that's probably the bias that's going to be ingrained in me forever. I will always be fine with taking a chance on a kid who doesn't, like, you know, if you murdered somebody, yeah, I probably am not going to say, yeah, go for it. But if you, you know, did drugs or didn't like a coach or whatever, something that's sort of minor, I'll probably always say go for it. If we look at the roster, the sort of biggest change from this is that it means Justin Jackson will not be on the team this upcoming year. I think we all kind of assume that.
I wasn't completely certain one way or the other. He talked last week or 2 weeks ago after an AAU game, he was in town and he talked about it was still up in the air and he was going to make his decision soon. The spot I think everyone sort of assumed the spot was being left open if he decided he wanted to come. So I have to assume that he made his decision and probably let the UNLV coaches know, or they worked it out somehow and they decided like, yeah, let's go, let's move ahead and let's try and bring in a transfer then who can help us. So, it looks like Jackson, not this year, but he's still, the one thing he said was that he was still committed, whether it was 2015 or 2016, he said he's still committed. So I think he's still, you know, in the plans, and he's still a big part of that 2016 class. But for whatever reason, they just decided to go with Obekpe.
Yeah, I don't know. You think it's better or worse for Jackson to, because presumably he would have come to UNLV and been redshirted this year. Do you think it's better or worse for him to go back for another year at Finley Prep or come to UNLV and be redshirted for a year?
It's not gonna, I don't think it's Finley Prep. I think he's going to have to move to Finley, so
okay.
I think he's going to move on to like a prep school somewhere. So
okay.
He would be doing a year at a new school. But I don't, just from logic, it would seem like for long term and like for UNLV's sake, UNLV probably would have wanted him on campus, you know, practicing with the team during that redshirt year to, you know, sort of get acclimated to it. It's probably better for him in the long term, but I don't think it's that big of a deal. You know, he'll get another year at the high school level. The school he ends up at is going to be playing like top competition anyways. Like he's going to be in good hands, I would assume. So
yeah.
I'm not so focused on that. Like I think whenever Jackson gets here, like he's going to be ready to go.
All right. Maui Invitational.
Wait,
we'll wait.
Sorry, the other point I wanted to bring up, like for just Robekba, in terms of talking about roster and classes and stuff, I think that the other reason why you would want him and why he sort of fits is that Zimmerman is still sort of unknown whether how long he's going to be here. Like, I think, would you agree at this point that Okonobo seems like a 3 or 4 year player at this point? I don't think they have to worry about him going pro after this season.
Yeah, no, he'll be.
But Zimmerman is, you know, sort of, he could blow up. He could be gone after this year. And Obekwa gives them, like, a guy that they can rely, like, hey, we have this guy. If Zimmerman leaves, we have another guy who's ready to can step in and can handle big minutes in the post.
Yeah, absolutely. Is this getting Obekwa, like, since the season ended, this is kind of the first move we've seen with Dave Rice that doesn't have to do with this upcoming year? Right? Like, because it's all, everybody's saying it's a make or break year for Dave Rice. He's got to do this. He's got to make the NCAA tournament. He's got to make whatever. He's got to be a Mountain West contender. And really every move he's made has been, you know, Ike Wamu for a year, Steven Zimmerman for a year. But this is a guy who he's not even going to be able to get to use this year. And if it truly is a make or break year, it could be a break year. Dave Rice is gone and Obekba's here at UNLV with a different coach. This is, though, like the first move.
Yeah, where he
at least roster wise, that's not focused on the upcoming season.
Yeah, it's the first, and it's like the first player that's committed to him beyond this season. I suppose you could throw Jackson into that category as well. Like he's committed for 2016, but he committed, you know, last fall. So Obekwa is like the first guy to sort of give him to put his future in Dave Rice's hands since like the whole job situation came up last off season. So yeah, it's a case of the Rice is sort of looking forward to next year and then even like 2 years down the road.
And he's got short shorts. Oh, we are going to see so much Obekwa.
I've heard it. Now I have a question. I was looking at some of the like the Twitter photos that came out. Does he actually have like short shorts, or is he just like rolling up the baggy shorts that they give him and like just hiking those up?
If I remember correctly, he was rolling them up, but then whoever St. John's athletic provider is actually made him short shorts last year.
If you can tailor like some actual short shorts from, you know, the 80s and 90s, like that's a fan favorite right there.
Yeah, oh, I'm under the I don't know if that's true. I just think I remember that happening, that he was rolling them up, but then it was like, you know, they played on ESPN or something, and everybody was like, why is this kid, why can't we see halfway up this kid's leg? And eventually, I think St. John's is Nike, but I might be wrong. Whoever it is made him legitimate short shorts. So, oh, you're going to see so much Obekwa leg. It's wonderful.
Am I just old at this point? Or do I think, I think short shorts look good sometimes. Like, if you have, like, the old school, like, tight jersey, like the tight around the torso jersey, with like the long arm straps, and then you have like the short shorts, like that can look good in certain combinations. Or
absolutely. No, like you said, certain combinations. I don't think I want every player out there running around in short shorts, because then it loses its appeal of kind of being different. But it's certainly cool if, you know, 1 to 10 guys is doing it.
I don't know. I'm looking forward to seeing if UNLV is gonna appease him and give him his own shorts and how that's going to work out.
I hope so. I hope real question is, did he have practice shorts that were short?
I don't know.
Cause that's going above and beyond. Like, yeah, you get game shorts. People see those. It's a jersey. It's a big deal. But practice shorts, like, nobody sees those. Like, the coaches see them. It's important. It's probably my favorite part about by far my favorite part about Chris Obekpa,
if,
is that he went short shorts.
And it could be fun, you know, if he gets on the court and he's doing well and it becomes a thing, you know, you could have the Hey Red mascot running around in short shorts. You could have the Rebellion, you know, all dressing in short shorts for certain games. There's so many possibilities.
Is if he and Okonobo are front court partners, is O Brothers a terrible nickname?
I don't know, but all I have to say is you have 2 years to come up with. I know you're going to come up with some pun for his name. You have 2 years. It better be better than Oblakpa. You got to do better than Oblakpa. If you had, maybe if he was signed, if he committed here and he was like suiting up for a game tomorrow, that could be okay. But if you have, you know, 24 months to come up with a name, like you got to come up with a better nickname than Oblakpa.
I didn't even come up with that though. You just are assuming
no,
that's what
I'm just that's where I'm putting the bar. Like you have okay. Whatever you end up calling him, it has to be better than that.
I feel like though we go separate rate. Like you have that bar in the middle. What I think is good goes one way, and what you think is bad goes the same way.
I mean, so bad it's good is like an actual. That's a thing. Like that can work sometimes, but I just think that.
But that's what I'm always going for, is so bad that it's good.
Well, and I take that into account when I say, if you come up with something so bad that it's better than Oblakpa, that's okay.
But I feel like I received too much criticism from other members of the media for my puns this past season,
I think people like giving you a hard time just because you're putting yourself out there doing it. A lot of people are afraid to do that. People are afraid to have fun, you know? They want to be, you know.
Exactly. That's the, like. God, sports is supposed to be fun, and Twitter is supposed to be fun, so Twitter about sports is supposed to be glorious.
I think a lot of people are afraid to have fun, so they'll sort of give you a hard time, but I think they're actually people actually enjoy it, or they think it's fun.
I don't think people... See, the one I'm disappointed about that I think is maybe the best one I came up with last year was Knick Knack Patty Mac, and I don't feel like that got nearly enough love as it should have.
Just keep pushing it, man. Just keep pushing it.
Like that one is glorious. It is. It's like probably the best one I came up with, and nobody cares about it. But anyway, we'll go to curling the stash now. Bullet points of the show. First one, Pat McCaw. Apparently, he's going to change his jersey number from 2 to 22, according to a advertisement on UNLVRebels.com, where I think it's for season tickets. He's pictured wearing a jersey number 22. Jelani Kendrick wore that last season. 22 is also my favorite number because it's my birth date, so Pat McCaw keeps doing things that make me like him more and more.
You have a favorite number that you, it's like your go-to number?
Oh yeah, like if I was, yeah, anytime if I was or will be on a sports team, that's the number I will pick.
Man, okay.
Every time.
Whenever I hear someone that has like a favorite number, like I can get like a favorite color because it has like some aesthetic value, you know, because maybe it's just a pleasing color to your eye or whatever your brain chemistry is. Like, hey, that color works for me. But a number is just a random, like, arbitrary value system that we've assigned to things. Like, I don't know how someone can have a favorite number.
Oh no, I understand, but I'm just saying, like, that's the number I will pick. Like, if you play sports growing up, you didn't have a number you always wanted?
Not really. Like, it's really? I don't know. It just didn't appeal to me.
You're weird. Like that.
That's what I'm saying. Strange. Like I when I meet other people, when they say they'll say, oh, that's my favorite number, and I'll just look at it like, why is that a favorite? Like, why? How can you have a favorite number? I guess. What?
Well, let me ask you this, because in soccer, the number 10 is often given to, well, it's for a certain position, but it's often the team's best player, like Lionel Messi wears number 10. If you grew up a huge soccer fan and your favorite number is 10, and it's because of that. Would that be weird?
Is that the same thing as a color?
No,
that number has like sports that significance to that sport.
Okay.
The same way, like, aren't liberos in volleyball? Don't they all wear like the same number as well? Like whatever.
Oh,
that
you say libero.
How is it pronounced?
Libero. And people say libero too, and
libero.
I think actually libero and libero are both technically correct, but libero sounds
well,
so.
I'm trying
stupid.
To say libero, but it's just my Boston accent. It's pronounced as libero. No, I don't know.
They just wear different colored jersey. They don't have a certain number.
Like,
as far as I know,
like I can see,
they don't have a certain.
I can
number.
See you wearing like if you want to wear a number to honor someone, like if you say, oh, like my favorite player was number 8, so I'm going to wear number 8. Or if like my dad was number 8, so I'm going to wear that number. Like that's okay, but like a number is not, it's too abstract to have like a favorite to attach like any emotional like significance to it. But that's just, we can move on to the next thing.
I have emotional attachment to 22, but anyway, smaller sports, Rodrigo Fuentes, who's on the UNLV men's soccer team, was named to the Herman Mack Trophy watch list, which is 30 players. That's essentially the Heisman of men's soccer. He's the first UNLV player ever to be named to it. So kind of essentially saying he's one of the best 30 players in the country. As far as my knowledge of men's soccer, a little bit of a surprise that he was named to that, actually.
So it's like, it would be like the golden boot for soccer, for college soccer, except that you're not allowed to give college players gold or anything with monetary value.
Herman.
Or it's just a boot. It's like they're giving you this boot. Here you go. You're
boot.
On the list.
Just imagine the boot. Soccer season is coming soon. The men's soccer team, their first game is an exhibition game against UC Irvine on Sunday, August 16th. UC Irvine is the team that knocked them out of the NCAA tournament last year. The women's soccer team, they don't play an exhibition. Their first game is a home game on Friday, August 21st, and then volleyball starts the next week on August 28th.
So where is this? Where are they playing Irvine?
It's at UNLV.
And that's the team that knocked them out of the NCAA tournament last year?
Yeah.
So how heated is that game going to get? Is this going to be like Stadia Azteca, where like people are flinging bags of urine? Like, is it going to get that heated?
No.
Or is it?
Not quite.
Okay.
I mean, not quite. But here's the thing. So they actually just in the last calendar year, they played in the regular season. UC Irvine beat UNLV 4-2 in the regular season, and it was by far, like, the worst game UNLV played. Like, the men's soccer team was really good last year. I think that was the only time they gave up more than 2 goals in a game. Like, UC Irvine ran all over them. They got matched up in the NCAA tournament. Irvine, I think the final was 2-0 in the NCAA tournament. And so Irvine beat them both times last year. They actually played in the spring. And they played, 8 spring games. They played them in the spring, and I have no idea how that game went, but I know they played them in the spring, too, and now they have an exhibition. So it'll be the fourth time they will have met in, like, 11 months or
something. That's a blood feud.
Yeah, it is. So it's an exhibition, but I hope it gets kind of dangerous. Women's basketball, Elena Cesars, who was the team's second-leading scorer this past season, graduated. She's going to play professionally in Portugal. Which sound like that just doesn't. Maybe I'm more fascinated with like living in Europe playing a sport than other people, because I know I talked about this with Chris Wood, but doesn't that sound like I'm going to go play women's basketball in Portugal for money? Like, doesn't that sound awesome?
I mean, it would appeal to a lot of people, not to me, but to a lot of people. I can get it.
You don't want to live in a
different
country?
I'm not a travel person. I'm not a foreign travel guy.
You moved across the country, though.
Within the country, though. Like, I'm okay with the United States, but foreign travel puts me on edge. Puts me too much on edge. I couldn't deal with it.
There's so much, like, I guess, opportunity for, like, playing sports professionally in Europe. Mm-hmm. You don't might necessarily get paid a bunch, but I know, I've heard a story, a couple softball players went and played in Europe, and I don't remember what country. They didn't get paid a lot of money, but they got paid, and, like, their room was paid for, and some of their meals were paid for, and they only had games on the weekend. They would practice some during the week, but essentially Monday through Friday, they just got to run around whatever country they were in with no responsibilities except for, hey, practice is at 4 today. Like, that sounds glorious, doesn't it?
It sounds good if like you want to explore other cultures and do all.
But you don't care about other cultures.
It puts me too much. You know who else thought that foreign travel would be fun? Is Amanda Knox, and then she ended up in prison for like a decade for no reason. Like that doesn't scare you? That scares me. Like I'd rather be here where like I know my surroundings. Like I know I'm gonna be okay.
I don't know. No, I'd go somewhere else. I mean, going back to I covered Marshall Henderson, he played basketball in Iraq. I haven't
heard a lot of good headlines coming out of Iraq lately, not to make light of that situation, but I haven't seen a lot of good headlines coming out of that area of the world lately. So like I wouldn't pack my bags and run over there at you know, if that's just me.
Okay. Pat Armstrong, former UNLV baseball player. He called a couple UNLV baseball games with me on the Mountain West Network this past year. He's going to be a grad assistant for UNLV baseball this upcoming year. He was like on the grounds crew or something for half the season last year. I don't know what he was doing, but he was doing something. But now he'll officially be sort of a coach. And then football season starts September 5th with the road game against Northern Illinois. But fall practice actually starts August 7th, and most of those are open to the public. Not all of them, but most of them are open for everyone to go see. But I think they'll slap your phone out of your hand if you try to take a video. All right, now moving on to the Maui Invitational. So wait, would you go to Maui?
I would go to Maui. A tough one would be like Puerto Rico, or like, because that's like it's U.S. territory, but it's still kind of like different and exotic. Like, I don't know if I could do that.
Would you go to Canada?
Like an English speaking section of Canada? Yes.
Oh, I don't. Is it not all English speaking?
I haven't renewed my passport in like 15 years though. So like I would have to do all that, and it seems like a hassle just for Canada.
Oh, Jesus. Like Canada's like America, but like not as gun-happy or something.
Yeah, no, I mean, I could do Canada. Like, it would be a hassle, but I would do it.
Jeez.
Like, I'd need a reason. I wouldn't just go up there for like a weekend. Like, hey, let's go to Canada. It sounds like fun. Like, if UNLV basketball did another tour of, like, a preseason tour of Canada, and Run Rebs wanted me to cover that, and they sent me on the trip, I would do it. Like, it wouldn't be that bad.
Okay, Maui Invitational. Mike might be afraid to go to Maui, but UNLV, they'll get UCLA in the first round, and they will match up with either Kansas or Chaminade in the second round. And, like, it's not 100%, but we're getting Dantley's revenge, aren't we?
I mean, if you ask me right now to, like, pick that game, like, UCLA is probably going to be favored in that game, I would have to think.
Dantley's revenge.
And then Chaminade is probably going to lose their first round game. So then you're looking at that bracket, that second round, UNLV versus Chaminade.
Woo! That's, I like that. Good job, Maui. Good job, Maui Invitational.
It would have been a little too obvious to stick them against each other in the first round.
Do you think they know or care that Dantley Walker transferred from UNLV and is at Chaminade? And do you think they even know or care?
I think so. I think you have to. Like, Chaminade is like the one school that... Like, that's the host school. That's the one that, you know, fair or not, teams really hope they don't play when they get to Maui. So I think they take a little bit of care with who they schedule against Chaminade and, like, the potential, like, second-round matchups for them. So I think it plays into a little bit. I don't know if Dantley Walker's enough to move the needle. Like,
Dantley demanded
it. I don't think the committee was, or whoever set the schedule was like sitting down and saying, oh, we've got to rearrange these entire brackets. We've got to throw everything out and rearrange it now that Dantley's going to Chaminade. I don't think it's like that. But I think that they are aware of the history.
So UNLV's third game will be one of St. John's, Vanderbilt, Wake Forest, and Indiana. And really, there's only one of those you don't want, and that's Wake Forest. Indiana, Vandy, St. John's will probably all be decent teams next year. Indiana was 53 in RPI. The other two were both in the top 50. KenPom, not RPI. Wake Forest was 124 in KenPom last year. So that's who you want to avoid in that final game. So worst case scenario in terms of scheduling, not in terms of winning and losing, but in terms of who they play, would be UCLA, Chaminade, Wake Forest. If those are their three games, I think almost regardless of win-loss record, that's almost a failure, just because you thought you were going to get some quality opponents. You'll get one in UCLA, but then Chaminade's not doing anything for you, and Wake Forest isn't doing anything for you if you're UNLV. If they get UCLA, Chaminade, Wake Forest, you could look at it and say, well, hell, we could have scheduled three games better than that on our own.
Exactly. But I think the upside, though, when you talk about like a Maui, like the upside is what you want. Like, the upside is UCLA, Kansas.
Yeah. Best case is UCLA, Kansas, and then probably Indiana. They had the lowest KenPom of St. John's, Vandy, and Indiana.
But But for name value and like that, I think that's still for the fans, like that still counts for something. Like if you can go to the Maui Invitational and play UCLA, Kansas, and Indiana, like that's a trip that's worthwhile, or that's like you're happy about that scheduling.
Absolutely, and if you play those three teams, that means you beat at least one of them more than likely. I mean, you could conceivably play those three and lose all three of them, but that includes Chaminade beating Kansas. But you would conceivably win at least two of them more than likely. But I think I look at it and sort of the likely scenario is UCLA loss, Chaminade win, and then they get St. John's or Vanderbilt or possibly Indiana in that. I think that would be the fifth place game. Which I think you'd be okay with because UCLA is going to be that's going to be a good game for your RPI, for your schedule. Chaminade's not, but then St. John's or Vanderbilt or Indiana's not anything that kills you. It could potentially help you depending on how good they are, and all three of them could potentially be decent, at least within their conferences. So if it's UCLA, Chaminade, and just say St. John's, is that... Do you look at that as a positive? Let's say they go 2-1. Do you look at that as overall Maui was a success?
I would say it's probably neutral at that point. I wouldn't say it's like a rousing success. I wouldn't say it's like a terrible failure. Like that would be like the middle of the road result. Like I don't think you could wave the pom poms like one way or the other. Like if that's what they come away with, I think it's mostly going to hinge on that UCLA game. Like if you win that first game, that sets you up to have a really, really good tournament and like a really worthwhile experience. If you lose that first game, the best you can probably do is break even.
Yeah, and that's a really important first round game because the loser of that is going to get Chaminade, and the winner is going to get Kansas. And
that's a huge. That's I mean, you can't come up with a bigger gap between like Kansas and Chaminade. Like that first round game is very, very big.
So Do you like the way they didn't really stack the bracket because UNLV wasn't any good last year, but essentially you have the two best teams on the same side in Kansas and UCLA, and then the worst team is Chaminade, and then UNLV was bad last year, has higher expectations though, and then the other side is kind of your 3, 4, 5, 6 teams in the tournament.
No, I mean I don't think you can pay too much attention to that. It's like they have their. It's. I don't think it's really going to play much of a factor in it. It's just
who is underseeded at Maui, Mike. Let's go. Who got left out?
Which UNLV got put in the group of death? That's bad, I guess, for UNLV. But no, it's if they win UCLA, then no one will complain about the. If they beat UCLA, no one will complain about the brackets or the seeding or anything like that.
Oh, but there will be complaining. There always will be. Okay, I guess we'll talk about recruiting, even though I despise talking about recruiting. Like, I know recruiting's important. I'll never not acknowledge that, but God, it's not. Like, I like sports and the actual sports part of sports, not the roster acquisition part.
You don't want to talk about 15 guys that they're recruiting, one of whom might suit up for the team 2 years from now?
Yeah. None of which are driving. No, not entirely. But
I think this is like the one, if you're going to talk about it, it's like early signing day, late signing day, and then July in Las Vegas. Those are like the three times of year that you really want to hit recruiting. Like just in general, when someone commits, like that's a story that you want to, that's when you take a sort of a look at, take a snapshot of where you stand in recruiting wise and roster wise. But those, like, this early signing period, late signing period, and then last week you just had, like, a bunch of AAU tournaments converging on Las Vegas for the weekend, and just every college coaching staff in the country is here. Pretty much every player that you would want to see from every class is here. So it gives you a chance to, like, it's very easy to track the coaches and see, sort of keep an eye on who they're watching and, like, sort of the maneuvering that's going on with these high school players. So I think it is, if you are going to follow recruiting, like, that's one of the important times of the year.
Well, I'll say this. I think it's recruiting, like, fans care about recruiting, like, way too much. Fans care about recruiting and, I mean, especially, like, football recruiting in the South. But, I mean, they follow basketball recruiting too. I mean, the whole Scout and Rivals like network of sites that cover each team, they're built off of covering recruiting. Like that's why they exist and that's why they charge you know, premium fees to access their content is because it's about
recruiting. Recruiting is hope for fans. Like, if there's always hope. Like, you can all, you're always recruiting, like, the next big thing. And, like, these recruits are always going to be, you know, if you're going after a 4-star guy or some 5-star guy and you think you have a chance on, you think you have a chance for him, that's the guy who's going to turn your program around and take you to a Final Four. Like, you can project that onto any, you know, top recruit that you want. You know, even, you don't even have to land him. You can just be, like, in his final 10. And you can still project that, oh, what if we get that guy, and, oh, he'd be so great, and this and that. So it's like, there's a lot of, like, wish casting that goes into recruiting. Like, I agree.
All right.
But that's why, it's it's popular and people want to follow it.
What do I need to know about UNLV basketball recruiting? Like, this better not take more than 2 minutes.
I'll give you the quick recap. Thon Maker is apparently happening. They are recruiting him seriously. Woo! They offered him last year. Their interest kind of waned a little bit when it looked like he might reclassify to 2015. Then Maker decided to stay 2016. A couple other recruits fell through in that class for UNLV. They're back on Thon Maker, and apparently they're recruiting him hard. So that's what, and he's the guy that went viral last year because he's like a 17-year-old, 7-foot-1 guy who can like dribble and shoot and everything. So he's he's already like a star, and even still in high school.
All right, pause your 2 minutes. Thon Maker, dear God, come to UNLV, because that is name pun potential. Like, he's got to be number one. Yeah. Like, there is so much there with Thon Maker.
Can you give us a preview of one? Like, I know you probably got like a dozen that you've got, you know, in the holster, but can you give us like a preview of one?
I'll just tell you this. I considered getting the Thong song and playing it as a music bed under this entire show.
The Thon song.
Just the entire show. But okay. there's so much there. Like, you've almost got Thor and you've got Maker. Like, there's a lot going on with Thon Maker, and it's not a lot of letters either. It's short, so there's a lot of stuff. But there's my input on recruiting. Dear God, get the kid with the cool name, because that'll be exciting.
Yeah. Well, and the thing as I was saying, I was telling you before, like a thing off the air, it's Obekpa sort of ties into this, as he now that he is giving them sort of like a Zimmerman insurance that a lot of people say you can't count on Obekpa, like who knows if he's ever going to suit up, like he's troubled or this or that. But if the coaches are reasonably confident that he's going to play in 2016-17, that gives the UNLV coaches another year of recruiting to sort of land like a long-term solution at that 4-5 spot. So now it's like you can put your eggs in the Thon Maker basket, and if that doesn't work out, you've still got another year to recover and try to recruit someone else. Because if you're recruiting Thon Maker, you've got to – I don't know this for a fact. Like, I don't have sourcing on this, but just from the way recruiting goes, you pretty much have to tell these kids, like, yeah, we're not recruiting anyone else at your position. Like, you're our number one option. We want you to come here. We see you as being, like, the linchpin of your recruiting class. Like, you have to make them feel like they're the star. So now that you've got sort of Obekpa in your back pocket, you can focus on one guy in recruiting and sort of go after that guy, knowing that you sort of have a safety net if you don't get him, because you've got some time. So I think that's
Thon Maker.
So I think Thon
Maker basket sounds pretty sexy.
Yeah, well, it's a long way. I know you don't like recruiting because it's like a long way away, and Thon Maker hasn't even, like, he doesn't even talk. Like, it goes, like, everything.
He does not speak English.
He grew up in Australia, so I assume he has an Australian act. He's like a refugee from the Sudan who grew up in Australia. He still has Australian citizenship, but he played basketball in Virginia 2 years ago. Now he plays basketball in Canada at the same school that Jalen Poyser graduated from. So he's, like, been all around the world. But I assume he has an Australian accent. But I've never heard him speak. His guardian does, like, all his talking for him. He's, like, his guardian / personal coach. And he does, like, all the – he's, like, the contact person for all the colleges and everything. So most of these college coaches have never talked to Thon Maker either. I think they, like, mostly go through his guardian. So it's, like, a weird, like, mysterious recruiting process. Like, no one knows, like – he doesn't have, like, a top 10 or a top 50. Like, no one even – it's just unknown at this point. But – so that's what's going on with Thon Maker.
Would you go to Australia?
Oh, that's a tough call. That's
it's like America with kangaroos and the toilets flush the other way.
I don't know.
And it's hot during Christmas.
It's awfully close to Singapore, though, and that's where that American guy got caned. dude, he was doing he was spray painting graffiti.
He got caned.
Like they take out a, that's like a medieval like barbaric like they strapped him down and caned him.
Do you like watch the news specifically for American tourists getting
arrested? The stuff that sticks with me. That's like a very neurotic fear that I have of being like falsely imprisoned and having like no recourse because you don't speak the language, or they just the justice system in other countries is like not as refined. Like people complain about the American justice system, but it's 1,000 times better than the rest of the world. Like you could spend a lifetime in prison for nothing in one of these countries. Do I sound xenophobic?
I mean, you just sound like you need to go to a different country.
I'm definitely an uncultured American. Like, I don't know how things work in other countries, and I'm afraid of it. And I guess that's probably the dictionary definition of xenophobia. So I guess I have that. But it's not in a malicious way. It's just I'm comfortable in America. I know how things work here. Like, I'm okay here.
I want to go to other countries. Like, I want to do that.
Like, I suppose I could do England, because that's, like, America's father. That's still, like, the family. So Australia is kind of, like, our
cousin.
No, it's, like, that was, like, a British penal colony at first. So that's, like, the stepchild. That would be, like, our stepbrother that we, like, never talk about. So, like, if I could do Australia if I had to, but like England, I could do like Ireland, I guess, like the British Isles. If I could stick to that, like that would be a place I could travel to.
Okay, all right, let's go recruiting. You got to tell me something about like 76 kids going to Finlay Prep and why you know he's going
to
get it.
I'll just tell you one more guy is Skylar Mays, who I personally happen to like. I know he's from Louisiana, so he's got him and Jordan Cornish are like, you know, retweeting each other and tweeting a lot. He's a guard. He's like a 6'4 guard. He is transferring to Finley Prep. It's looking good. He came to UNLV for an unofficial visit a few months ago, or maybe even more recently than that. So he came on his visit and then he left. And like the day after he left, he announced that he was transferring to Finley Prep for his senior season. He's a 2016 guard. So, I mean, that looks like UNLV is going to have a really good shot at him. And then I saw him playing here this weekend, and I get a chance to, like, talk to him. And he looked impressive. Like, he's off the dribble. Like, he was just dribbling through teams and dunking, like, as a guard. So that's impressive. So I would say, like, those are the two. Like, that's – for 2016, I would say, like, Skylar Mays is probably the first guy to look at.
So Finley Prep. Lots of good players come from there. Lots of guys have gone from there to UNLV, to the NBA.
Like UNLV is recruiting pretty much the entire Finley Prep team. I think they have scholarship offers to like 7 or 8 guys that are going to be on Finley Prep next year. So it's basically the whole team.
If we kind of assume that Dave Rice has a good year and is here for a few more years at least, the way that the relationship is developed with Finley Prep, would there ever become a point where a really good player is at Finley Prep, UNLV is recruiting him, doesn't get him, and he goes somewhere else and is really good? Is there any point where that situation would get held against Dave Rice?
Where what situation would get held against him?
Like a star player is at Finley Prep and UNLV doesn't get him.
No, that's happened because that's happened before. So like
but it feels like it's getting more and more like Dave Rice loves Finley Prep and they have obviously that strong connection. Like I don't know. I'm just saying, like, could it get to the point where, you know, oh, he's right under your nose, you're such a great recruiter, but you couldn't land him, now he's just dropped 27 on us in the non-conference or something?
I think that momentum definitely plays a part. Like, once you can get, like, that first Anthony Bennett-type prospect to commit to you, other people sort of view your school more legitimately as a place for, like, top guys. But mostly it's a case-by-case basis. Like, Finley Prep is no guarantee that Dave Rice should land someone just because they go to Finley. The only thing it does is it puts you very close to UNLV, so you sort of get a taste of the culture, and it puts you right down the road from, like, Todd Simon and Ryan Miller. So those guys can pretty much watch – they can come watch your games whenever they can. They can watch your practices. They can contact you. You can come to the you can come on as many unofficials as you want. You can watch UNLV practice. So you can get really close to the program, and you get a – like, when you talk to kids for, like, recruiting – they say, you know, they want to go to the NBA, and they say that they want to be able to trust the coaching staff and have a good relationship with the coaching staff. The thing that gives you a good relationship with a staff is just getting to know them. Like, if you get to know someone and, like, you trust them that's going to make you more inclined to want to put your future in their hands. So if a kid is playing at Finley Prep, UNLV just has a certain geographic advantage where they can really get to know these kids and really let these kids get to know them. So I think that's what helps them the most. So it's a case-by-case basis.
So recruiting, probably going to shoot myself if we talk about it again. Not really. I mean, it's not terrible. Like, I'll be honest, it's not terrible. I just
it's interesting covering it for UNLV just because they're in on a lot of these like top prospects, so that's kind of exciting. And then you know they do land like a good number of them. Like that's been Dave Rice's strong suit since he's been here. Is that like pretty much every recruiting class he brings in is good and right. Interesting in different ways. So
yeah, and I mean it. It is, like, it's always going to be important because it's the lifeblood of your program. Like, regardless of what college sports you are, recruiting is probably the most important thing. But it's just, I just like sports. I don't like the trade deadline in pro sports. I've never been a big trade deadline guy. Just because, you know, it's more interesting than recruiting because they're going to play for that team tomorrow. But I've just never been that crazy about, acquisition.
So you're not like a draft guy either.
No, not
see,
at
I
all.
I love that. My favorite days of the year was when the NFL used to have their draft on like a Saturday afternoon, and it would be on for like 9 hours. Like that was like my favorite day of the sports year. I would just like camp out and just like watch that whole thing, and like I love the drafts.
I just can't imagine. Like I'm a sports fan. But I like the draft more than when they actually play the game. Like I just can't comprehend that.
Well, when you grow up watching a lot of bad sports teams, which I did, like I came of age during the Rick Pitino Boston Celtics.
That's your hope.
Yeah, it
that's
was like the
hope.
Pitino Celtics and the Patriots before they got Bill Belichick and Tom Brady, so they were awful every year. So like that, when you grow up watching bad teams, you kind of learn to love the draft.
It's you can't lose the draft as easily as you can lose a game, huh?
Yeah.
Do you have anything to complain about?
Besides like foreign travel and and
I don't know.
And
just right, I mean,
besides foreign travel and numbers, like people having favorite numbers and covering recruiting and all that stuff that I already complained about.
Did you see anybody back into a parking spot recently?
No, but I did tweet out a photo a couple weeks ago. The office building where I work. There's a parking garage, and they have it clearly labeled on the posts in the garage. They all say, do not back in.
It's your favorite parking garage.
I love it.
you just feel a little bit happier every time you park there.
Yeah, I mean, how could you not? It's outlawed. I haven't seen anyone try it yet here, so I'm perfectly content.
Are you going to try enforce it if you see somebody? Like, are you going to wait outside and then point to the sign when they get out?
I don't know. I'm a little more Weasley than that. Like I don't like confrontation. Like I'll just go to like the management. I'll go to the garage management, and I'll on the sly write down the license plate, and then I'll take it to the management. I'll say like, hey, go up on the third floor. Look at the way this car is parked. Like this car is backed in. What are you gonna do about it? Like that's more my style.
Fix this. We cannot have people backing in my garage. Okay, you're strange, Mike. Like, so like if you were in a country that didn't speak English and everybody was backing in the parking spots, would you explode?
I would be gone. Like I would stow away on the next boat or plane or train or whatever, and I would get out of there. Travel is not for me, man.
Oh, poor Mike. Poor Mike. You can just go to the Strip and go to New York City and Paris.
That's what I tell people. I say, why would I have to leave the country when I have the Eiffel Tower, and I can see Paris, and I can see Egypt, and I can see Rome, and I can see the canals of Venice. Like we got it all right here. Why do I need to leave?
It's just like traveling, just like getting on a plane and flying for 10 hours, mm-hmm. Huh? Okay. Well, he's Mike Grimala over at RunRebs.com. I'm Tyler Bischoff here at Mountain West Connection. This has been the South.